Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne. With me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
And joining us for this special season on forensic psychology, psychology of serial killers, whatever we want to call it, is Dr. Sarah Tracy.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
So I guess I'll start with sort of a reminder of who we are and what we do on this podcast, and then we'll get into introducing our esteemed co-host for this semester, season, whatever we want to call it. We're a academic podcast. I don't know what we want to call ourselves anymore. But for any listeners, students, whoever might be listening, we try at the beginning of these seasons to kind of tell you, and we're in what, season six now?
Mm-hmm.
105 episodes. But our goal here is to provide like supplementary information through interviews, applied content, whatever might be more interesting than just like a basic reading of the textbook. So we kind of go beyond the text. Usually we work with an open source textbook, but as we've been getting into some more specific topics, cognition, religion, and whatnot, we don't always have a textbook to go with it, but we're going to kind of cover a lot of the basics that we would typically cover in a class, but beyond the class itself. So this isn't a replacement for a psychology class, but this is definitely a supplement for anything that you might be interested in within this field. And if you're interested in social psych or cognitive psych or intro psych, we have older episodes on that as well. So we hope that any new listeners enjoy what we kind of have in store as we kind of move forward. We've got a lot going on and a lot of plans for the future with this. So we welcome anyone. And with that said, we'll kind of get on with the show, as it were. And so, like I mentioned, we're a bunch of psychologists, and we really interested, Thomas and I, really interested in getting into talking about forensics and then the psychology of more abnormal behavior. And just like when we talked about cognition, we're not abnormal psychologists, not clinical psychologists, not counselors in any way, shape, or form. And so joining us is Dr. Tracy. And so I guess you tell us a little bit about yourself, Sarah.
Yeah, so I would say I am a counseling psychologist, clinical, and have worked with clients for years. I have not as much recently as I have in the past, but my doctorate is in counseling psychology. And I've been teaching for, since 2006? I've been teaching for quite a long time, and then was allowed the opportunity to come up with a new special topic, you know, kind of with a new elective in the psychology department. And so my mind went straight to serial killers, for better or worse. And so I've been teaching this serial killer class for, 4 or 5 years. So for quite a while, there's always something you can learn. There's always something new. I'm really, really excited to talk about it. And I'm excited to be here with my esteemed colleagues and dive into some really interesting cases and interesting facts about forensic psychology. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We're very excited to have you here. Yeah. I guess one disclaimer is that you're also with us here at New Mexico Highlands University. And the serial killer class I've noticed is like hugely popular. Does it typically run two sections for that class?
There have been several semesters where I've had to add another section because otherwise I was going to have, you know, so many extra students. So we just went ahead and made it two sections this semester. Yeah. Very, very popular.
That's fantastic. Do you usually get mostly psychology students or do you get lots of like interdisciplinary action in that class?
I get a lot of criminal justice. And honestly, that's really been awesome because I've learned a lot from them. And I actually used to have a criminal behavior textbook along with like a more sort of strictly psychological, you know, aspect. But I decided to kind of just keep it straight psychology. But I would say that those are the two major disciplines. There are probably some other ones sprinkled in there as well.
That's awesome. I took, Daniel, did you take a serial killer class in undergrad?
I did not. I think I'm just part of like the general public consciousness of, hey, this is interesting. Why do these people do this? So I want to learn everything about it. But I don't know. I guess my experience with it has either been to like stay away from a lot of the mainstream stuff, or like the occasional episode of Law and Order, which is not a really good example of anything. So yeah, I'm kind of on the fringes, on the outskirts, maybe some got into Criminal Minds a little bit way back in the day, and then also understand that that's not a really good representation of a lot of things.
No, it's Sarah's job to disillusion the undergrads who come in as Criminal Minds fans.
Yeah, there are a bunch who want to go into the FBI, and it's like, you know, this is a little intro, but there are also then some videos that I show that are really graphic, and then I think people realize how strong their stomach is or not, so, which I get. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I took a serial killer class in my community college. It was like this Wednesday night class for like 3 hours, and the instructor was... she was a investigator for one of the surrounding counties. And she was like, I don't know, she was like 6.5 feet tall.
Wow.
And like just the most intimidating, but like sweet woman ever. And she would tell us these like horror stories of like crime scenes. And like, I think the worst one she said was this woman had like passed away in her like little house out in the country in the summer, without air conditioning, and they didn't find her for 2 weeks, and she was the carpet because she had like melted down in her house. Like, it was a pretty graphic and horrifying class, and then I would have to wait for my ride in the dark parking lot at the end of that class.
That's awful. Oh my gosh.
I am gonna have to record a persistent, ever-present intro to this season to warn, hey, we're gonna be talking about some disturbing things.
I feel like you should know if the season is entitled Serial Killers.
It's true. I kind of give that disclaimer to my students, yet, you know, and especially before there is a video that's graphic, but then I also had, come on, you chose to take this class, so like, yeah, I mean, you should kind of know what you're getting yourself into, for sure.
Mm-hmm. That's, I have to do that with the sex class too. I'm like, you signed up for human sexuality, like, you know why you're here,
right? Yeah.
So one of the things that's kind of, I guess, been in the back of my mind when thinking about this, especially a lot of the misconceptions, and maybe that's where we can start. I remember early on when I did advising, I had a student who came up and said, hey, I'm really interested in doing forensic psychology. And I was like, cool. I don't know anything about that, so let me see if I could find some information for you. And I still have this letter today from someone who does forensic psychology. And they were explaining, like, this is what we do, and this is what I had to go through with it. And it's not like going to work at the FBI. They're like, I work at a psychiatric state hospital, and this is what's involved in that. And there was this sort of like, this veil opens up as you read this email. And every now and then I get a student who's like, I'm really interested in forensic psychology. And I'm like, all right, I want you to know what you're getting into. Here's this email. Here's the copy. And it's usually either they get it and they want to keep going with it, or it's like, well, let me find another field of psychology. And so maybe we could kind of talk about that, is kind of this difference between where your studies are versus like forensics, which we're not really going to get into. But that kind of disconnect between like working with or trying to study like a serial killer from a psychological perspective versus from like a criminal perspective or a criminology perspective or a forensic perspective.
Yes. And that I'm glad that you brought that distinction up, because I would say that there's definitely some overlap. A little bit of overlap in the sense of what, you know, as psychologists, what we find interesting. And I can see forensic psychologists, forensic workers at the FBI also looking at a few of these similarities as far as maybe is anything missing from the scene? Did the perpetrator take anything? And so certainly I would assume from a forensic viewpoint, they would then be looking for that item and seeing, you know, where it is, who has it, has anybody seen it? And from a psychological viewpoint, I'm thinking this person's collecting trophies. Mm-hmm. What is the meaning behind the specific item or items that they took? We have seen there are a lot of serial killers who have fetishes. And so they'll take clothing items. They'll take shoes. They'll take underwear, pantyhose, things like that. There are other serial killers who will take jewelry. And not very often will they take like their ID or anything, but we definitely see that they want to have something in their possession that they can use to look at later and relive the excitement to them of what they did to this other person. And so, you know, it's one thing to think about it. It's another thing to actually have this object with them. Sometimes, you know, people think about the show Dexter and how he kept the little slides of the little blood samples from each victim. So I certainly say that is a teeny bit of overlap, but also, again, as you can see, a pretty big distinction in how we view that, you know, the taking of an object. Also, even the placement of some of these victims. I'd see forensics potentially looking at, well, why did they move the body, or why did they put it in a certain place? And, you know, as a straight up psychologist, I'm interested in how that relates to potentially their sexual fantasies. Because we see with serial killers, and you can look on the internet and some sites say, oh, not all serial killers are motivated by sex. And it's true, but I would say a very, very large percentage are. And so oftentimes, you know, and I would say another part of that as well is looking at whether or not the serial killer or the perpetrator goes back to the victim, goes back to where they put, I almost hate to say that, the body, you know, it almost depersonalizes this human being, but sometimes they'll go back, and oftentimes it is for necrophilia. Mm-hmm. And even maybe like if the head has been taken apart from the body, well, what does that mean as well? And then looking at types of rage, you know, is there overkill, things like that. So yeah, there's definitely, given the same circumstances and situations and evidence, a lot of different ways of looking at it. Mm-hmm. So I would say those are at least a few examples of some of the distinction there.
When we're talking about serial killers, could you kind of distinguish them from just say like maybe a run-of-the-mill murderer versus like maybe a mass murderer or like a public shooter or something like that? Like, what are we like specifically talking about when we are discussing serial killers? You said that there's like typically a sexual element to it. There may be exceptions to that. Like, could you kind of walk us through like what exactly is a serial killer?
Of course. So one of the distinctions that is made, or some of the distinctions that are made, are between serial killers and mass murderers and spree murderers. So serial killers are different in that The definition is that they have to have killed at least three or more people and have a cooling off period in between each murder. So it's when you think of mass murder, you think of somebody maybe going in and, I mean, I hate to say it, but these school shootings or, you know, places like that. And then, so that is four or more people to be a mass murderer, kind of in that category, all in one place at one time. And so the spree murder, that can take place, I would say, over most likely just a day, but they're going to potentially go from one place to another place to another place. So part of it really relates to locale. I will say that with some serial killers, they will find their victims in the same place. And then they will, you know, do whatever they're going to do, oftentimes in the same place as well. And oftentimes that's comfort. So potentially, I mean, some of the classic cases, which I'd much rather talk about some of the cases that are less well known in the next few weeks. But like John Wayne Gacy is one of those, and Jeffrey Dahmer, and they brought these men back to their house. And so it's not like these are different locations, but I know that with John Wayne Gacy, he kind of had ads where he needed a worker or someone to come and help him with his yard or whatever it was. And that's how he roped them in. But they tend to keep finding people where they feel comfortable. So again, it's so much more drawn out than these other types of murder. And oftentimes they will pick a victim. They'll find someone and they'll learn what they can about that person. When are they home? When are they not? When do they go to work? Does anybody else live there or not? So there also tends to be that stalking factor versus I've been planning this. So the premeditation aspect, but with mass murders, I'm just going to go in and kind of do it all at once. And I will say as well that there are some documents that indicate that when it comes to serial killers, they tend to use firearms. But what we really find is a large distinction there as well, in that they want to be up close and personal. They usually, end someone's life with strangulation or stabbing. Because they want to be right there. They don't want to be far away just with a gun. And then again, oftentimes then there's a sexual satisfaction that they get from that act and from seeing the person, expire, for lack of better words. So a lot of differences there. Yeah, it's a good question.
I have this article. I have two articles on necrophilia in my human sexuality class that I have my students read, and it's probably the most brutal part of the class, is like kind of the typology of different necrophiles, and like whether or not they're like experimental or preferential or sadistic, and how they get to the point of, desecrating a body.
But there are even some cases where I feel like with serial killers, sometimes they like to just go and relive this. But even then, there's some cases where they grave rob.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, with some of them, it isn't necessarily sexual. I think that's another aspect too, when it comes to having a body, is sometimes they're interested in what's inside. What does this look like? How does this work? And I feel like sometimes maybe they could have used that in a much more pro-social way and maybe become like a doctor or a surgeon or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's interesting.
Well, who was it? Was it Ed Gein who grave robbed in addition to a bunch of the other murders that he did? So I guess I have a question about So one of the things that typically comes up, and maybe we'll try to parse some of this out over the course of the season, is the sort of nature of like history. So traumatic childhoods, some aspect of abuse or whatnot. Is that that's kind of the stereotypical view of like the serial killer. And it's I guess the disclaimer is that not everyone who experiences these things becomes serial killers, but like with the sort of sexual satisfaction thing, like is that part of it too, where you see this trend amongst serial killers with some issue or abuse or something regarding like their childhood that might point in the direction that it create these sort of maladaptive behaviors.
Definitely, most definitely. And I will say, jurors or investigators say, oh, this person's childhood was completely normal. We cannot find anything out of the ordinary. They just have not dug deep enough. Or somebody's hiding, or many people are hiding a bunch of family secrets. They're keeping those skeletons in the closet. Because,
Bodies in the crawl space, skeletons in
yeah,
the
they're. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Either way, they're hiding and they do not want anyone to know some of this stuff. But yeah, you're exactly right, Daniel, in that there we see some of these sexual interests when they're very, very young. They're also, and yes, we will get into all of this in a bit more detail later, but abuse, physical abuse, a lot of neglect, sexual abuse. We also see a lot of traumatic brain injuries, a much higher proportion than in the general population. And certainly it would depend on where the head trauma occurred, as to how it kind of affects their personality. But it's a fairly common, I should say, assumption that when somebody does have a head trauma, that it can change the personality a little bit at least. And oftentimes they tend to be a little bit more angry. I've talked to several people who've had traumatic brain injuries and they agree. They say, yeah, my ability to cope and my level of anger has really increased since the trauma. And they're just some of the worst situations where, I mean, children are forced into sexual acts with parents, with their parents, partners, things like that. And then we also see, speaking of Ed Gein, where some of these serial killers are told that sex is awful. It is a sin. These women or men, they're evil, they're dirty, stay away from them. And so you have this huge taboo against sex in general. When is so then of course it leads to all of this confusion. And they, they don't know what's kind of even how to have a relationship. And some of them love their mother, some of them hate their mother. And then religion can even tie it into some of that when it comes to their childhood of in connection with sex, right? So, be a really good, whatever religion they ascribe to, and stay away from women and things like that. So there are loads and loads of things that occur when these people are growing up that you could say are red flags, but of course, there are people who've gone through awful situations growing up and end up to be very, very productive members of society. So, and we'll talk a little bit as well, later about the MAOA, the warrior gene, or really an enzyme. And so potentially the connection of that and almost this perfect storm. So, yeah, there's a lot there.
When I took my serial killer class as an undergrad, that's I think we're at like 10 years ago now. We talked about like the precursors of, I think it was like antisocial personality disorder, or maybe like precursors to serial killers as like children being like, what is it, pyromania, like abusing animals and bedwetting. Is that triad still in use, or has that been refined, or where are we at with that?
That is still in use. Yes, you're exactly correct. Pyromania, interest in fires, interest in studying them, a lot of, I hate to hear about, even talk about harm of humans, let alone animals. But yeah, we do see a lot of that. And it's almost like it escalates. It starts with fantasies in their head. They slowly start to act them out a little bit with animals. Certainly easier to get away with it. And then it moves on to people. And then, yes, the bedwetting is one of those that I think people are most confused by. And so I will say that we do know that it is not uncommon for children, even up to the age of 12, to wet their bed, urinesis, every once in a while. But with serial killers specifically, we see it go on well into their later teens.
Is that like an
And
issue with like bodily control or?
that's, I don't know that we 100% know. I would say that it's due to trauma. It's due to trauma. It's due to lack of control. It's due to oh my gosh, sorry, inability to regulate all sorts of things. Not only their emotions, but some of their bodily functions. And I sometimes wonder if some of it is spite in a way. You're in this really awful, abusive household, and what's a way to really, piss your parents off, especially at that age. So yeah, so that still does hold true today. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Interesting. Yeah. And is this usually like, do we like catch the stuff early, or is this usually like we learn this about the serial killer after they've already been caught?
Depends. I would say, I would say it would be 70-30, about 70%. The parents or somebody in the family would know that these things are occurring. And at about 30%, they're able to hide it really, really well. But oftentimes they're not very shy about these acts. And so we'll place like a decapitated animal's head somewhere very noticeable. Or again, not to talk too much about some of these super already high profile cases, but with Ed Gein, when he was even hospitalized, so this would be afterwards, but again, there's a lot that we know now about him. But they were doing a psychological assessment and said, asked him to explain the saying, two birds in the hand is worth two in the bush, something like that. And he just giggles and says, if I have a bird in my hand, I'm going to squeeze it until I kill it. That's where he goes with that. There's nothing else there. I will say that in some of these cases, obviously they want to continue to kill. So they try to hide it as well as they can as they're older. But yeah, a lot of times there are these signs, especially with harming animals.
It makes me think with some of these too, like we get into this realm of like maybe that 30% that are really good at hiding it are where we see kind of some of the most successful. Because if you're not good at hiding it, you're not good at that level of control, like it's going to be a lot more obvious. I would say, I guess, with the exception of all of those cases where the signs were clear and everyone was like, oh, it's okay, you can go, or they pretended not to see it, or whatnot.
Yeah, honestly, I think in some cases, because the families are already pretty dysfunctional, that the parents don't want anybody, they don't want to bring attention to anything going on in the home. And you know, maybe they're doing some things like this, some similar types of activities.
Mm-hmm.
And that could certainly be part of it.
Do this kind of idea of like control and hiding, I guess I have like a two level question. One of them is there like a distinction between like messy, for lack of a better word, or like disorganized serial killers and like hyper organized ones? And then what do we think, or like what are the estimates on like the number of people that aren't caught? Like, are we only catching like half the serial killers, do we think? Or like, are they all tend to be pretty messy and they eventually like come to the surface anyway?
There are a lot who haven't, I'm sure, gotten caught. We even know with Joseph D'Angelo, he was the Golden State Killer.
Mm-hmm.
He was a former police officer. Only reason he was caught was due to a family member doing the DNA testing.
Mm.
And they were able to match that up with him. That, and of course, with the crime scenes. So the ones who were organized and the ones who, I would say, again, as much as they can, they're trying to get away with it. But certainly there are some who are just so emotionally connected and invested. And I don't know that I necessarily want to relate the IQ to these cases, but I think in some sense, yes, because to some degree, to get away with it three or more times, sure, you have to have some level of aptitude.
Mm-hmm.
I will say sometimes the law enforcement just does not, they're just missing the mark sometimes, mm-hmm. honestly, and sometimes it's luck, it's chance. But then there are some who you're just really surprised that they even got away with it,
mm-hmm.
as many times as they did. It's difficult to know what the current, I would say, incidence is, because we don't know, obviously, right? But certainly you could look at maybe how many unsolved cases there are. But we do know. There is a document, and I don't know if it's like 25 to 50 serial killers, at least just in the U.S., at large at any given time.
Mm, okay.
My guess, probably more.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more, or even some budding serial killers. And we do know as well that when some of these cases are really publicized in the media, you see a lot of copycats.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they want their name. They want what they did in the media as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because some of them do want to get caught.
Well, they want the notoriety.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so they will write to the police. So I would say certainly these are ones that have to be much more organized, much more meticulous to be able to be that brazen to literally write letters. Though I will say with the Zodiac Killer, he's never been caught, even though there are some former, detectives who think that they finally decoded
mm-hmm.
the letters, and then were able to figure out his middle name. And so, that person passed away in 2018. So that's
So we don't know if it was them or not.
And honestly, it sounds morbid, but I don't know, and I'm sort of surprised that they have not exhumed the bodies to get DNA evidence to see if that was the person or not.
Right.
I'm sure there's so much legal mumbo-jumbo
mm-hmm.
involved there, but yeah. So
you know, also, like, what's the rush on it now? Like, they're obviously inactive.
Yeah.
And if it were a family member of mine, like, would you want to give like the write-off? Like, if we're talking about like family issues, you don't want to be a member of the family who's associated with like the Zodiac Killer. So you're like, you can't exhume my uncle's body or my dad's body or whoever, because nope.
Well, you know what's interesting? I'm glad you brought that up, Daniel. What's interesting is that there is a man, I cannot recall his name right now, who is convinced that his dad was a Zodiac killer, and he's doing everything he can to convince law enforcement.
So yeah. Maybe there's the flip side of that, where it's like, maybe this guy wants the notoriety.
Yeah. I mean, my guess is that he wants to then be able to write a book and make a bunch of money on it.
Mm-hmm.
This is my guess, because why else would you want to be associated with somebody like that? And to really just spend a lot of your time to convince others, yeah, this is definitely my dad.
Mm-hmm.
That's my only guess.
Isn't there, because there, I remember reading an NPR or listening to an NPR report on, it's like one of, I think, not Gacy, it was, I think, Manson's kids. And he's like a white collar business person. He just like does his thing and he keeps quiet. But like, it's pretty sure that he's one of Manson's, like he's related to Charles Manson. He's quiet. He doesn't want anything to do with, happened to do this NPR interview, but like it's the only time like he's ever been really open about it. And I think they did it as sort of like this is why like the genetic lineage, like we shouldn't put too much on like the kids of serial killers don't become serial killers, and these individuals like they may not have a family history. There are other things that we need to look for, things like that.
Yeah, that's one question that I get asked pretty often is what becomes of these serial killers' children? And a lot of times you can't find anything about them because they are hiding, because they do not want to be associated with this person.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine the backlash you would get, or now people, the stigma, people's assumptions that now you're going to do something, the family members now trying to go after you. There is a case with the BTK, bind them, torture them, kill them, Dennis Rader, where, so he has two children. I don't know which one's older, son, daughter, but the son wants nothing to do with the media or anything. And the daughter, after probably 25 years, finally was able to work through the trauma enough to then give interviews, to then write a book as a way to really process this information.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it, and honestly, I appreciate it, because then you get to see how these people can compartmentalize their lives. They have two lives that are extremely, extremely distinct. And so the daughter of the Dennis Rader, and neither one of them are serial killers, you know? I mean, she has a family. She just wishes she could go back and erase what her dad did. The house has been ripped down. She can't take her children to their grandparents for Christmas, you know? So she's lost a lot of things. But she talks about how they go fishing. And he was the Boy Scout leader, and he was a congregation president, you know, all these different things. So it's this perfect facade where it seems too perfect to be true. But yeah, you know, and the poor thing, I mean, in these interviews, you can tell it's just really difficult for her to even talk about it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to think about it and to sort of look at where her house used to be. It's painful for her. But yeah, most do not end up going down that path. There are a few. So Andrei Chikatilo in Russia, he's known as the Butcher of Rostov, which is a city in Russia. His son wanted to continue the legacy. And I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but I feel like sometimes the apple really falls extremely close to the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they can see the notoriety that their parent has gotten. And some of them, they want the glory. They want the spotlight. They love it.
Right. Yeah, no, it's like almost like a anti-hero, like, fame and mysticism around it, This idea of the facade and the serial killer, like that reminds me of like the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde archetype. Is that typically what we see with serial killers? Is that they like maintain like this highbrow, professional, good old boy life, and then like there's this other side that they keep hidden?
You know, the ones that are more organized, yes.
Okay.
What the ones that are not, they're the ones that you would think that we have a stereotype of who a serial killer is, sort of this loner, you know, maybe was bullied, some things like that. They're ones that probably get caught sooner because that's the preconceived notion that we have of who these people are. But yeah, there are some who have families and children and regular jobs. It's just that exact, and I bring that up as well, the Jekyll and Hyde, that they are able to have their excuses, and they tend to be really valid. There was one time with Dennis Rader, he was at a Boy Scout, again, he was a Boy Scout leader. So he's at a Boy Scout camp retreat, but once everybody's asleep, he leaves. And then he goes and murders someone. So they have the perfect cover up. It's not really suspicious, but yeah, to have these normal quote unquote jobs, I would say probably a larger percentage don't have that neat facade. It's definitely a lot messier, but some of them have been married multiple times. Some of them frequent prostitutes very, very often. And they often end up being their victims. And there's some serial killers who will choose street workers as their victims because they know that nobody's looking for them. They know it's easier to get away with them. Or even they'll choose minorities. And, you know, I don't just want to see men and women, but that's kind of what it tends to be. Choose minority women because they know that there won't be as much press. So they're, you know, some of that thought to really have those thought processes, you know, facade or not, I think is takes some other level of intelligence. But yeah. So there's a lot involved. There's actually, so with the Samuel Little case, he's considered, I think he was just caught a few years ago, with actually a very low IQ, but a photographic memory. So if you look him up online, he drew pictures of every one of his victims. Apparently, it's extremely accurate. But he admits that he's African American, that he chose African American street workers predominantly, and then when he chose a Caucasian street worker, that's when he was caught. Because that case was in the media, that case got press, therefore that led to his capture, which is just,
Wild.
yeah. And then he knew. He goes, as soon as I chose a white woman, then I get caught. So I know, Yeah. So I mean, even with a lower IQ, he knew. He still knew who was marginalized and who was not gonna be sought after as much, which is awful.
Well, I guess we're nearing our time.
We are indeed.
This has been a really good kind of introductory talk to a lot of these concepts. What we're gonna bring back, I guess, for our have to keep a regular outline to our show. I would kind of explain this to you at the beginning. We sort of do this sort of a bias of the week or something of the week at the end of each episode, and I'll try my best to kind of link it to what we're talking about. We have probably talked about this bias before, but I want to do it again, as a return of the bias of the week. And so I want to talk about hindsight bias, because I really think that is kind of fitting with some of the people that we're going to be talking about this season with some of these cases, is that while we can look back and go, oh, it was so obvious, Ed Gein was the person involved. It was so obvious that Manson or Dahmer or Gacy or any of these sort of famous individuals, or even not well-known serial killers or spree killers or whatever, like, you know, whatever we're talking about with this, so obvious that we're looking at them. But hindsight bias really fits with that, is that looking back, we can go, oh, obviously we're showing this and this event happened. And then obviously they were doing this. So this is Fischhoff and Beith, 1975. This is the tendency to see past events as being more predictable than they actually are. I think we're all probably pretty well versed in hindsight bias at this point in our psychological careers. But yeah, I don't know. Thoughts? Anything with that? That just that with what we might be covering in the future, and regarding how much hindsight bias are we going to be invoking when we talk about some of these cases?
We're invoking a lot of it. A lot of it. So many red flags. And they're huge and they're waving in the wind. And how did we not see these? There definitely are a few cases where family members knew what was going on. Dahmer's dad was a chemistry teacher. He had all sorts of potions. And he knew that Jeffrey was taking animals and using different types of chemicals on them to see what would happen. Certainly didn't say anything. But yeah, I mean, with some of the upbringings, it's not super surprising, though. Of course, there are people in those same situations who end up being very productive members of society. But yeah, yes, there are some of these red flags, this hindsight bias of, wow, this person is really interested in fires and is maybe a little bit more interested than the average adolescent. And, you know, we know that with your nieces, bed wetting, that can occur into early adolescence, but maybe, okay, well, what led this person to continue that, even beyond that? And so many other things, especially I would say with some of the more recent cases with social media, that if somebody isn't looking into what's being posted, you know, then the information's gonna be there. But yeah, so that's definitely gonna be a huge part of a lot of these different cases. It's just so many signs, and yeah, how did we not see them? Or sort of right thinking, oh, well, that was obvious, you know. I definitely noticed that, but it maybe could have paid some more attention to it. So yeah, that'll be a common thread for sure.
It's almost like too, that like you can notice like with Dahmer's dad, right? Like my son's doing weird things with chemicals and animals, but may not have had like the framework to like understand that little piece of information too. So it was just like one instance that was unconnected to a bunch of other ones without those like connecting lines. And then when we look backwards with hindsight, we're like, oh, here are all the lines. Why didn't you notice this? And it was just like a bunch of random events that then they could look back and tie together, but not see in the moment.
Exactly. Yeah, it's almost like the aha moment. You know, it's like, oh, okay. Which I will say in the case of Dahmer, his dad admits to having similar thoughts, but never acting on them. So my guess is, he knew what was going on. He probably assumed that because he didn't cross that threshold, cross that boundary, that Jeffrey would not. But I also think that he was happy to keep all that under wraps.
Right.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I see a little bit too much of me and you, and I don't want to face that.
That's definitely, definitely what was up. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he even wrote a book. I've not read it, but.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess on that note, well, so yeah, this is going to be an exciting series of discussions and talks over the course of this season on serial killers and forensic psych, and I'm very excited. This is going to be a lot of new stuff to me because I don't even have the course. I don't even have a 10-year-old course on serial killers and forensic psych to back anything up on, and so it's going to be all new. And so all new, all exciting. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for joining us for our continued conversations as our resident expert this season on these topics, Sarah. It's gonna be great.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I will talk to y'all next week. Thank y'all
Yeah,
for listening.
with that, we'll tell everyone goodbye.
Adios.
Bye.